Ahava and Yira, love and awe. Two basic characteristics of Avodas Hashem, of Judaism, of service of Hashem, which can seem contradictory and mutually exclusive. Ahava, with its focus on accessibility to Hashem, intimacy with Hashem on one hand, and Yira, with its focus on reverence, a God who is beyond, a God who transcends, a God who cannot be brought down and humanized. These can seem mutually exclusive, but they are in fact not. Love and awe are an inseparable pair. It is the marriage between Ahava and Yira which makes for a true relationship to Hashem. Because Ahava without Yira is cheap, trite, a God who does not command respect, reverence, authority is not God anymore. And to relate to him without Yira is not to relate to him anymore, but to relate to some figment of our imagination. So true Ahava, as in forging a relationship to him as him, hinges on Yira no less than Ahava. And we will see tonight that our parsha centers on this healthy balance between Ahava and Yira, the inseparable duo. Let's begin with the tragedy in our parsha. Our parsha should have been a celebration. The Mishkan has been inaugurated. Hashem's presence resides amongst us. And yet, it turns to sadness when Nadav and Avihu, the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron, worship incorrectly and are struck down. They characterize, we will see, an Ahava without a Yira, serving Hashem with love, but with insufficient awe. To begin, Medrash portrays Nadav and Avihu, or portrays their motivation as follows. When they witnessed the fire from on high descending down to the Mishkan, they were so excited. They were drawn, lehosef ahava al ahava, to add love to love. Hashem had showed his love by resting his Shekhinah, as represented by this fire which descended. So they sought to add the love, and hence they were drawn to approach and go forward. But their avoda was not welcomed, was not appropriate. What exactly was incorrect, lacking in their avoda of love? So the Torah lays out very clearly and factually what they did wrong. It tells us they sacrificed Esh Zarah, foreign fire, a foreign fire pans of incense, Asher Lo Tziva Osam, which they were not commanded to sacrifice. Voluntary incense, which they were not told to bring, was wrong here. Because in fact it is prohibited to offer ketores, to offer incense on one's own initiative without a divine imperative. The Torah says exactly such back in Parshas Tetzave regarding the ketores. Lo sala alav ketores zara. Do not sacrifice upon the incense altar foreign ketores, i.e., as Rashi explains, ketores of nedava, incense which is voluntary in nature. And you will actually hear with your sensitive ear an echo between these two verses. The verse in our parsha describing Nadav and Avihu's wrong deed, sacrificing Esh Zarah, foreign fire, and the verse I cited in Parshas Tetzave, which mandates against Ketores Zarah, foreign incense, using that same word, voluntary incense is deemed foreign, is deemed inappropriate. and therein lays Nadavanavayu's failing. Now, this ritual misdeed of unmandated incense needs explanation. Does Judaism not welcome volunteerism, initiative, spontaneity? Does Judaism demand an explicit command from Hashem before we engage in any avoda, not leaving room for any creativity on our part? We know the contrary is true. In fact, in the Mishkan itself, there are many offerings, animal offerings, sacrifices, which are brought as an edava, as a voluntary offering. So apparently, there is some fundamental difference between ketores, incense, and other avoda. Specifically, incense must come with a mandate from Hashem. Why so? And I think the key is to realize incense, the altar of incense, the Mizbeach HaKetores, does not lay in the courtyard, in the open space of the Mishkan, but rather it lays in the Kodesh, in the holy area. It lays in the more secluded area of Shechina, which means that when one brings incense, they are entering the King of Kings' inner sanctum. They are standing in the presence of Hashem. And when you are standing in the presence of Hashem, you act with an I-Iser. Hashem, I submit myself, I subordinate myself, because to do otherwise is to be unaware of who you're facing down. You are in the holy. You are in the Kodesh. Hashem is staring right in your face. That yes, in the courtyard, in our broader lives, outside of the inner sanctum, human behavior, human initiation, human creativity is what Avoda is all about. But when you enter that inner sanctum to bring ketores, realize that you are standing in the King's presence. And when you're in the King's presence, you do what you are told. So ketores, the inner avoda, the avoda done in the presence of the King, with its mandate, do what you're told, serves as the balance to all of the creativity, all of the human initiative and human expression of most of the avoda, of most domains in our lives. But there is the realization that during the sacred moments, when we are literally in the presence of the divine, we do what we are told in acknowledgement that this is not do-it-yourself Judaism. And when we engage in creative behavior, when we are outside of the Kodesh, away from the incense altar, that too is not do-it-yourself Judaism. That is utilizing self-expression ultimately for avoda of Hashem, as reflected by the fact that when we are in the inner sanctum bringing ketores, we do what we're told. So the act of Nadav and Avihu, sacrificing uninitiated ketores, is more than a ritual misdeed. It is, as we trace twice over in the Chumash, called Zara, foreign. It's foreign to do that. Do you not, there's a visceral reaction on the Torah's part. This is Zara, this is foreign. Do you not realize when you enter the sanctum to sacrifice ketores? The King is right here. And when the King is here, there's a mode of behavior. The grassroots do not overturn the palace. So this ritual mandate of the ketores really is larger in nature, is a framework in nature for all of our avoda, creating that focus, creating that balance of yira along with ahava, and hence the offense of Nadav and Avihu, sacrificing incense in the inner sanctum this way, is seen as so lacking, is seen as so undermining of the balance of Judaism, of Ahava and Yira as one. And for this reason, we will find that elsewhere in the Torah, The Torah generalizes Nadav and Avihu's mistake. Beyond per se the ritualistic sin of sacrificing incense without a commandment, the Torah generalizes a much larger issue conceptually at work here. For example, in Parshas Achremos, when the Kohen is told, do not enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim, don't enter the Holy of Holies, an even holier chamber, whenever you want. He's told, don't be like Nadav and Avihu. Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe achrei Moshnei b'nei Aaron. Moshe was told this command, the Kohen shouldn't enter the Holy of Holies at whim after the two sons of Aaron died, bikarva sam, when they drew close, lifnei Hashem. Their sin is described no longer simply in terms of incense sacrificed incorrectly without a mandate, but more broadly, bikarva sam, coming too close. Now, there is no textual evidence that Nadav and Avihu actually entered the Holy of Holies. One opinion in the Medrash posits that, consistent with this verse in Achramos, but that is not the general consensus. Nadav and Avihu did not per se violate entering the Holy of Holies. What they violated was something else, was sacrificing incense without a commandment. But you see, the Torah is generalizing here. It is not per se which ritual they violated. But conceptually, the issue of bikarva sam lifnei Hashem, coming too close. Becoming too, we would say in street expression, buddy-buddy with God. He's not God anymore if there are no protocols. And our respect for protocols and reverence has all sorts of ritualistic manifestations, be it the issue at hand in the Nadav and Avihu story, sacrificing incense only with a command, or be it the issue of not entering the Holy of Holies at whim. But these are all manifestations of one core issue, which the Torah calls bikarva sam lifnei Hashem. Coming close, coming a bit too close without any sense of reverence. This is Hashem here. This is... And the truth is, we all have a certain sensitivities to a Nadav and Avihu. Love, free love, is a modern or postmodern type of word. We all want to cling close and warm to whoever we are in love to, but at times forget. There's respect in a relationship. There's respect in any relationship. How we make contact with our partner, how we make contact with the one we want a relationship with, needs respect. We want to connect to them in terms of who they are. And in the case of Hashem, bikarva sam, coming close without a sense of this is God, is not to respect the one we want relationship to. So this term, coming close to God without any sense or without sufficient sense of who he is, becomes a red color, flashing light expression in the text, which recurs, for example, in our parsha, when Moshe seeks to comfort Aaron, and he tells Aaron, they meant well. They meant well. They're holy people who made a mistake, your children. And he says, Hashem already told me events like this will happen. Bikrovai ekadesh. Hashem says, I will become sanctified amongst those closest to me. That those closest to me will err, such as Nadav and Avihu, and people will see from their error, will learn from their error. Lessons that there are to be learned. In this case, the mandate for Yira along with Ava. So you notice the expression bikrovai, those who draw close to me. Nadav and Avihu are once again described as those who are drawing close, those who yearn for a connection, but come too close in the sense of insufficient sensitivity to who Hashemis, to who the one we seek the connection to is. The issue is not less intimacy, less connection, austerity, but rather the healthy respect upon which relationship is founded. Because if we don't respect the one we're pursuing the relationship with, it is actually no longer our relationship, but actually an objectifying of the partner to pursue my needs rather than a true relationship. So I would suggest, and we will see for this reason, that there are many other examples of respect along with love in the Avodah, which are connected directly or indirectly to the Nadav and Avihu story. For example, immediately following the Nadav and Avihu debacle, the Torah mandates not to worship under the influence of alcohol, no avodah in an inebriated state. Now, some of our sages, some of Chazal say, this indicates that Nadav and Avihu actually worshipped under the influence. So hence, immediately after they died, the Torah is telling us don't worship under the influence. But the Chumash does not say this explicitly, that Nadav and Avihu actually drank, nor are all of our sages in consensus that Nadav and Avihu actually drank. So I would therefore posit, it really doesn't matter if Nadav and Avihu actually drank. It is the concept at work here. Why is it that we are not to worship under the influence? Wine evokes spontaneity, simcha, joy, and certainly has its place. But at the same time, it clouds restraint. And when one is engaged in avoda, restraint, a restraint not for restraint's sake, not for boundary's sake per se, but a restraint in judgment, in line with respect, respect for Hashem. Awareness of who we are serving is critical. So the Nadav and Avihu story teaches us, don't cloud your judgment. Don't do the free love thing when you're worshiping Hashem. And therefore, there are lessons to be learned here beyond, per se, Nadav and Avihu's sin. Few other examples. Midrashim posit that perhaps Nadav and Avihu worshipped without washing their hands first from the kiyar, from the laver. A Kohen is supposed to wash his hands. Other Midrashim suggest perhaps they worshipped without wearing all of their uniform, all of the Bigdei Kahuna. They were not wearing the me'il, the outer cloak of which a Kohen or a Kohen Gadol is supposed to wear. What are Chazal doing here? Splicing into the story of Nadav and Avihu. New offenses such as not washing their hands prior to worship, not wearing the uniform. I think what Chazal are seeing here is the issue of dignity, wearing the uniform, washing one's hands, rather than stepping right up to the plate, stepping right into the sanctum of Hashem without preparation. It is this issue of dignity which is conceptually connected to the offense of Nadav and Avihu. There's a way we go about things with Hashem. The formality of Avodah, and admittedly, formality might not be a popular concept today. But the formality, uniform, dignity, protocol, washing your hands, these are concrete manifestations of what the Nadav and Avihu story is really all about. When I think about and consider this issue of ahava and yira, which is really intimacy along with respect for our partner, I realize that this is really an existential issue in Judaism and Jewish history. The Jewish people seem to grapple with the need to include both. We have actual disagreement in the Jewish community about the Ahava versus Yira thing. For example, the Hasidic movement felt that the dry halachasists with their focus on formality were removing the lev, were removing the ahava, and we had to reintroduce some of that informality. You think about a Hasidish atish, where rather than a formal sanctuary, a formal Beis Medrash study hall, in a welcoming setting around a table with kichel and fish and vodka, Hasidim feel they are able to connect to Hashem through the informal. And the informal is necessary to infuse Ahava along with the Yira. And the Misnagdim, those opposed to the Hasidim, felt that this informality was removing the formality, was removing really the Yira along with the formality, the sense of who are you worshiping? You're worshiping Hashem here. He's not your buddy-buddy. That's making him into something you're not. But eventually, the soul of the Jewish people came to understand, in embracing both models, halakha along with Hasidus, came to understand we need both. We need the marriage. We need the healthy balance between the Ahava and Yira. And that's why I see the story of Nadav and Avihu in our parsha as a relevant story. A story which resonates with us and the rhythms and tensions of Jewish life. In fact, some of those caricatures or some of those images which I painted of the informal tish can actually be traced back to the Nadav and Avihu story. Because you might recall, back in Parshas Mishpatim, when the Jewish people are at Har Sinai, Nadav and Avihu, along with the elders, act inappropriately. They serve Hashem with inappropriate respect, described as follows. God did not react to the false, to the incorrect behavior of the princes of Israel, Nadav and Avihu. What was this incorrect behavior? Vayechsu es ha'lokim. They saw God, they beheld God, vayochlu v'yishtu, and were eating and drinking. Eating and drinking, kechel, vodka, herring, or whatever it was at this Har Sinai tish, beholding Hashem that way was considered inappropriate. Now this pasuk regarding Nadav and Avihu back at Har Sinai no longer reads as an independent passage now, but is rather a beautiful sister passage to our parsha and really filling out for us the Nadav and Avihu picture. This was Nadav and Avihu's failing, both at Har Sinai and then in our parsha when the Mishkan was inaugurated. The relatable drive to serve Hashem only at a tish, so to speak, eating, drinking, informality, relatability, but without the balance of the Yira thing. And I would actually therefore hope that we are developing a real sympathy for Nadav and Avihu. As much as Nadav and Avihu are the quintessential target of our parsha, they are criticized in our parsha, we begin to understand that these holy men called Krovai, called Hashem's close ones, were exactly that. Holy Jews who sought to come close, who sought to draw close in an admirable drive, but lacking the counterbalance. And I would actually posit that as we are getting to know Nadav and Avihu a bit better, relate to them a bit more, and their drive, and really a drive within all of us, come close, cuddle close with Hashem in an informal way, we have renewed appreciation for their very names and personas. Nadav, the word Nadav, from the word Nidava, volunteering, serving with spontaneity rather than a direct command, I sir, rather than simply following through on what you're told to do. It's an unmistakable coincidence that the very offense of this individual or individuals lays in the name Nadav, which invites us to study the second name as well, Avihu. Presumably that name too is brimming with meaning and captures the second brother's like-minded persona. What does Avihu mean in Hebrew? Avihu is a contraction of two words. Avihu, he is my father. He is my father means God is my father. Hashem is my father. He's my father. A father is a loving authority figure. An authority figure who one can have and ought to have an informal relationship with. He's my father. You could walk right into your father without a meeting. You could walk right into your father without ringing the bell first and arranging a schedule in the scheduling calendar. He's my father. And actually, we begin to appreciate from this perspective a midrashic nuance, which we touched on before. When Midrash suggests that Nadav and Avihu worshipped, lacking the garment, the uniform of the me'il, the external cloak. And I wondered, what is it about the me'il, the external cloak, which is significant here? That it was the lack of the me'il which gives picture and color to Nadav and Avihu's offense. Well, now I understand. Because the me'il, which has bells on the bottom, is supposed to serve the purpose. The bells ring as the Kohen enters the sanctum. As a ringing of the bell of sorts, the commentaries explain. That Hashem, before I enter, I need to announce my presence. There's a formality here. Well, Nadav and Avihu, Avihu, he is my father. I don't need a schedule. I don't need to ring the bell first. He wouldn't be my father anymore. And hence, midrashically speaking, they see no need for a me'il, for a bell ringer, or bells swaying on the bottom of the cloak. Every element of Midrash, no pun intended, rings and resonates with magnificence now, bringing to life this issue, this very relatable offense of Nadav and Avihu. The lack of realization that at the end of the day, as much as, yes, it is true, Avihu, he is my father. But we don't only call Hashem Avinu, but we also call him Malkeinu. He is our father, and yet he is our king too. Ahava and Yira, the inseparable duo. And as we begin to relate to Nadav and Avihu, we begin to understand that this was a lesson which the Jewish people had to learn at the very inception of Mishkan. V'shachanti b'socham, Hashem is drawing close. But close does not mean becoming buddy-buddy with him. And therefore, in a sense, the death of Nadav and Avihu was no less notable than the actual descent of the Shekhinah. That with the descent of the Shekhinah represented by the fire in this week's parasha, we saw Ahava, we saw an accessible God. And then in the death of Nadav and Avihu, tragically, we learned no less, along with Avinu, Malkeinu. And therefore, the death of Nadav and Avihu was actually itself part and parcel of the revelation, the intended revelation of Hashem on this day, of who Hashem is. To only see a God of Av and accessibility without Yira would be an incomplete picture. From this perspective, a medrash cited by Rashi in this week's parsha reads powerfully. when Moshe tells Aaron, Hashem kind of told me this was going to happen. Vayomer Hashem al Aaron, hu asher dibra Hashem. Hashem told me that tragedies like this would happen. Bikro vayakadosh. I, Hashem, will become sanctified through those who drew close to me. The people will learn through the deeds of the holy ones what not to do. Well, Rashi questions, how did Moshe know this? When had Hashem previously told Moshe tragedies like this will happen? So Rashi cites a verse back in Parshas Tetzaveh. When Parshas Tetzaveh projected how the inauguration of the Mishkan would happen, it says, V'no'adati shama, I will meet you there in the Mishkan, Hashem says, L'vnei Yisrael, I'll meet up with B'nai Yisrael in the Mishkan, V'nikdash b'chvodi. The Mishkan will become holy with my honor. And the sages midrasically read the word b'chvodi as b'mechubadai. I will become sanctified through my honorable ones, i.e., my honorable ones, the special people, Nadav and Avihu. I will become sanctified when people see how they are held to task for their misdeeds. Now this midrashic reread, v'nekdashti b'chvodi, don't read b'chvodi but b'mechubadai. Don't read it simply, I will be sanctified with my shechina, with my presence. But rather read it, I will be sanctified by the way I punish the honorable ones. Can seem like a loose play on words, a cheap reread, repunctuation of the text to serve a midrashic purpose. But upon closer reflection, we see that this Tetzaveh passage is a sister passage to our parsha. It is describing the very same event, the inauguration of the Mishkan. And therefore, when the sages see in the V'nikdash b'chvodi, I will sanctify the Mishkan through my presence, and they say, along with Hashem's presence, he is sanctifying himself by taking out, by punishing the honorable ones. We see how Chazal are fusing together both the revelation of the Shekhinah on that day, as in the literal read of the Pasuk V'nikdashti b'chvodi, along with the Yirah, along with the taking out and the punishing and the lesson learned, taking out the honorable princes, V'nikdashti b'mechubadai, Chazal are fusing the two. The Shekhinah that was destined to appear on that day, the Ahava message, along with the punishment and the lesson learned. V'nikdash b'chvodi, v'nikdash b'mechubadai, read as one, because the two are actually one of the same. Hashem's presence known through Shechina revelation, and Hashem's presence known through the painful punishment. Ahava and Yira are part and parcel of one greater revelation of Hashem on that day, and we need both. And hence, both can be read in unison in one pasuk, in the splendid fusion of Pshat and Drash. And the Jewish people got this. I believe they internalized this message on that day and understood we need respect along with intimacy. And the evidence is in the episode which immediately follows. When Aaron faced down this tragedy, Aaron, the father of Nadav and Avihu, faced down this tragedy of Nadav and Avihu dying. And he responded in silence, Vayidom Aaron, in this praiseworthy fashion. He does not express grief and undermine the celebration of the day, but he restrains himself. Very hard thing for a bereaved, grief-stricken father to do. Well, this behavior of stunting personal expression, containing one's own feelings in respect of the day and in respect of the Shekhinah, would seem to be a precise rectification, an immediate lesson learned. Aaron got it, and the Jewish people got it. It was lesson learned. And the evidence that to this understanding, that Aaron's heroic self-suppression reflects a lesson learned. The nadav and aviyu mistake was a teachable moment, tragic as it was, is reflected by a well-known statement of Rashi. When Rashi observes in the passage which follows, which we mentioned before, when the Kohanim are told not to worship under the influence, to have respect along with intimacy, as we explained. And the Pasuk says, Vayedaber Hashem el Aaron, Lamer. Hashem gave over this mitzvah, don't worship under the influence, to Aharon. Rashi explains, why was Aaron the messenger of the mitzvah here rather than Moshe? This was sechar, this was reward, because of Vayidom Aaron, because he restrained his grief. Because he restrained his grief on that day, he was rewarded to become the messenger of the mitzvah, don't worship under the influence. Well, what is the connection here between the two? Between Aaron's restraint of his grief and Aaron's reward as bearer of the mitzvah, don't worship under the influence. Well, now we understand splendidly. Aaron's restraint of bereavement, suppressing self in submission to the divine, reverse the tragic wave of that day, the nadav and aviyu failing of intimacy without respect. And therefore, he serves as the bearer of the message. We don't worship under the influence. We don't worship without restraint. Aaron got it, and the people got it. Thus far, a cohesive picture has emerged of tragedy but lesson learned when yira, when awe, when respect is lacking from the picture. And one can therefore see our parsha from a historical perspective as kind of a validation to the Misnagdim's perspective. Don't let the tish thing, don't let the informal thing get out of control. But I am convinced that for our parsha to be complete, there must be the counter message as well. Along with yira, you need ahava. Do not allow the restraints, the disciplines of Judaism to suppress, to choke the soul, the love, the passion, the accessibility of God. I'm convinced that counter message lays somewhere here. And the key and the lighthouse to that counter message will be in a thorough study of the Haftorah. You know, Haftorah is a magnificent institution. When the sages match up a sister narrative from the Navi to align with the Parsha. Not only does the Haftorah parallel a Parsha, but it really so often serves as a master counter-mirror image. The Haftorah will contain really so many clues and connection points, mirroring, perfect mirror image, the parsha, will oftentimes fill out the picture and sensitize us to other pieces of the puzzle, which perhaps we did not pick up on in the parsha. And let's see how our Haftorah does that for us in terms of balancing the Yira message with Ahava. Our Haftorah is a story from Shmuel Beis, also a story about inaugurating the Mishkan. What happened was the Aron, the Ark, had been inaccessible until this point. And most recently, it had laid in the house of a man named Avinadav. And finally, led by David HaMelech, the Jewish people were taking the Arun back and bringing it to Yerushalayim in a celebration of re-inauguration of the Mishkan and the Arun. And the Torah describes a tragedy which happened at the time of that celebration. As they carried the Arun away from the house of Avinadav, this individual's house where it was held, when the Arun laying upon the cattle shifted a bit, began to, in a sense, fall off of the cattle, and one of Avinadav's sons, a fellow named Uzzah, grabbed hold of the Arun with the best of intentions, that he did not want the Arun to fall, to shift. But this was an incorrect behavior. The Arun is not to be handled with one's bare hands. And Uzzah was punished. There was a horrible plague of divine retribution here. Now, this tragic episode, provocative episode, mirrors our parsha so resonantly. Again, a celebration of inauguration of the Mishkan. And a well-meaning Jew with the best of intentions, but who comes a little too close, a little too informal, in his case, handling the Arun lovingly with his bare hands, as though one could touch it the same way one touches anything else. But there is more here. You'll notice that the name of this individual, Uzzah, who grabbed hold of the Arun, Avinadav, father of Nadav, sets off this Eureka light. The father of Nadav, i.e. his son Uzzah, who grabbed onto the Arun, is a Nadav of sorts, is just like the Nadav of old. It is deja vu, it is the same thing. In a beautiful revelation of repeat story, of intimacy without respect, ahava without yira. Splendid. But yet there is a counter message here. Because the narrative continues to describe that despite this tragedy the Haftorah describes, the Jewish people led by David HaMelech refused to become austere, to become rigid, wood-footed. They continued to worship with joy, simcha, and dancing, understanding that the Yira message cannot come at the expense of Ahava. And therefore the Pasuk could describe, despite the tragedies which occurred, the David Mikarer Becholos, Mikarer Becholos Lefnei Hashem. David danced with all of his energy in a Simchas Torah-esque scene. And David understood, perhaps as the forerunner of Hasidus, this is David, the sweet singer of Israel, David the romantic soul, the poetic soul. Yes, we learned a message of Yira here. We don't approach Hashem with irreverence, but we also serve him with joy and personal connection and intimacy. And David was actually accosted by this, by no less than his wife Michal, Michal the daughter of Shaul. She told him, "What are you doing? You're the king of Israel. And here you're debasing yourself this way to dance." You understand? Michal is the daughter of Shaul, who was a much more austere king. You might say he's the forerunner of the Misnagdim. And she's like, as a king, you don't do this. Kings don't dance. And David says, "No, for God I will do this. I will seemingly lower myself to dance this way, because I am actually not lowering myself at all. In Simchas Hashem, dancing is not debasement at all." How provocative when we read the totality of this Haftorah. Following the Nadav and Avihu story, take two, the message of Yira, respect. We see that David understands and responds to his critic, his chief critic, his wife. That I will not allow Yireh to choke Ahava. I will continue to worship because balance could be achieved here. And don't allow anyone to tell you that Judaism is simply a religion of rules without a soul. David got it. David understood that Ahava must be fused with Yireh. And our Haftorah completes the picture, completes the portrait of our Parsha for us magnificently when we weave it together this way. Chasidim and Misnagdim, Ahava and Yireh, intimacy with respect. We can achieve both, and we must achieve both. And as if that weren't enough, there is yet another clue, a final clue in this Haftorah. You might see a John Hancock clue to this. That never allow reverence, respect, the halacha, the legalism of Judaism to stunt its soul. Because the Haftorah continues after it tells us of this exchange between David and Michal, husband and wife, tussling over this issue. Should we dance or should we worship restraint? It tells us that Michal, David's wife, who challenged him this way, tragically, Ula Michal bas Shaul, Michal Shaul's son, Saul's daughter, I apologize, Lo Hayala Yelad, she did not give birth to a child, Ad Yom Mosa, until the day she died. Michal struggled with infertility. Sadly. And one gets the sense, following the testy exchange between David and Michal, there must be a reason that the Navi in the Haftorah is highlighting that Michal, David's detractor, never bore a child in her lifetime. Somehow that relates to Michal's deed. How so? And again, we must approach Michal, who was a great individual, with kavod. But what can we learn from the fact that Michal, who criticized David and said, don't dance, her fate was never to give birth in her lifetime? Well, birth is all about life, cultivating life. Life means vitality. Life means dynamism. And life ultimately means joy, as captured by the splendid French expression, joie de vivre, joy of life. Joy is inseparable from life itself. Life is vibrant. Life is alive. Michal, who challenges Shaul, don't dance. Simply worship at the altar of dignity, at the altar of restraint, and you're the king, and it is beneath you to engage in a Simchas Torah-esque worship. Why is it that she never bears a child? If I may be so bold, Michal was rigid, Michal was frigid, and therefore tragically she suffered frigidity. She was unable to bear life because Michal, in her toughness, in her austerity, which was well-meaning, had no appreciation of lave, of joy, of intimacy, of connection, everything which is so necessary in raising a child. And think about people who are Yireh to the exclusion of Ahava type of people, rules as opposed to love type of people, and if they are capable of raising a child. There is certainly no experience which more expresses the cultivating nature of love than raising a child. And therefore so provocatively, but yet vibrant with meaning, the Navi tells us, Michal, David's critic, was frigid and remained frigid. And with all the tragedy of Michal, we once again learn an important message. And the Haftorah completes the tapestry of the Parsha with a final, splendid, beautiful coat to bring together a magnificent picture, a cohesive tapestry. Parsha Shmini should not be misunderstood as stressing Yirah to the exclusion of Ava, stressing Hisnagdus to the exclusion of Chasidus, as stressing respect to the exclusion of love. But we need both. It is love along with awe, intimacy along with respect, which holds the key to meaning. This is true in our relationship with Hashem. This is true in all relationships. Respect, dignity, reverence is not an altar in its own right. It is to enable greater intimacy, deeper intimacy. That if I want to know my partner for who they are, I respect them. I respect them, and under the conditions of that respect, then I can pursue them. So respect does not suppress the relationship. Respect sets an environment that we can pursue a relationship, whether a relationship to Hashem or whether any meaningful human relationship. And therefore, my friends, to bring it all together, I would like to suggest the Chasidus Atish side by side with the grand Gothic sanctuary. Both have their place. And what each one represents makes for a fuller, more complete, more authentic Judaism. Parsha Shmini and its sister narrative of Haftorah, which we came to own for ourselves and its meaning for ourselves tonight. In bringing together Ahava and Yirah, do not present a contradictory, hobbled or confused picture, but an ever more cohesive picture, an ever more harmonious picture to allow us to achieve everything we seek in relationship. And ultimately, in that most transcendent relationship as of all, the relationship to the infinite himself, Hashem himself. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to learn together tonight and bring this parsha to new life together with oh so relevant a message.